Hollingsworth, Ms. Orkin, and members of the commission for inviting us to talk about climate change with you today. I'm Lynn Hilbert, I'm the climate change coordinator for the agency, and with me is Dr. Mead Crosby, who is with the University of Washington's Climate Impacts Group. She's really our main presenter today. She's going to have the majority of the presentation. This presentation was a special request from Commissioner Keynes, I believe. He saw a similar talk several months ago and thought it would be of value for the commission to hear what she has to say. And I'm just going to follow very briefly after her to give a little agency perspective to some of the challenges and questions that she's going to raise. And before I turn it over to Mead, I just want to give a shout out to Mead and her colleagues at the Climate Impacts Group. I don't know how many of you have had a chance to work with that organization and the data and the really exceptional products that they produced, but we are so fortunate in our region to have that organization lodged here and working on behalf of those of us in Washington, the Pacific Northwest. And I think they take such extra care to work hand in hand with managers, very committed to making sure that they're helping us translate this complicated world of climate science into actionable products that we can use. So we're very lucky to have her here today, and especially fortunate because she had a horrendous drive down from Seattle. So thank you for being here, Mead.
Thank you, Lynn. Thank you very much to the commission for having me today, and thank you for your invitation. And thank you to the previous speaker for pinch hitting for me as I made my way down. Can you hear me all right? Okay. So I'm going to talk about fish and wildlife in a changing climate, some of the key impacts that have been observed and that are expected, and some of the things that we can do about it. I have to say this is not my usual impacts and adaptation talk because I was asked to give a talk similar to one I gave last year that is more about sort of my professional opinion on how we can work together to identify key areas to invest our conservation resources under climate change. And so I will give that brief caveat before I dive in. To get us all started on the same page, why are we even thinking about climate change and fish and wildlife? This is the observed change in average annual global temperatures over the last century. It's gotten 1.5, on average, 1.5 degree Fahrenheit warmer from 1880 to 2012. Most of that warming has happened since the 1970s. 10 of the hottest, or the 10 hottest years ever recorded happened in the last 12 years. So the trend is that it is getting hotter, and it's getting hotter faster. As you can see on this map, where purple is the most warming, orange is less warming, blue is cooling. Warming is not, we don't live in an average world. So even though the average global temperature is increasing, some areas are getting hotter a lot faster than others, particularly towards the poles. It's heating up there more quickly than towards the equator. White areas are areas we just don't have. We don't have the record from meteorological stations that we have in other areas, so we don't have as certain a record there as other areas. But either way, this is empirical evidence. It's getting warmer. Over the coming century, by the end of this century, we expect it to have warmed from 4.6 to 8.7 degrees Fahrenheit using a business as usual scenario. So if we don't adjust our greenhouse gases, it's going to get tremendously warmer. With those changes in our region come projected changes and observed changes in snowpack, so massive reductions in snowpack, reductions in late summer stream flows that are so important for our salmon and aquatic resources, changes in our disturbance regimes like fire. So there are a slew of additional climate impacts that we are observing and expect to observe in the future that come along with these changes in temperature and to a lesser extent precipitation. What is this doing to our species and our ecosystems in Washington? As far as observed changes, one of the ways that species are adapting to changes in climate that have already happened and how they will adapt is changing the timing of their biological events. So over the past 30 years, spring has been getting earlier, an average of 2.5 to 5.5 days per decade. And so that is things like flowering earlier, leaves coming out on trees earlier, insects emerging earlier. These are things that have been observed across thousands of species, including in our region. And we expect these kinds of changes to increase in the future. This is a very adaptive thing that species are doing to respond. The problem comes in the fact that different species are responding at different rates and to different cues, and you wind up having mismatches in species that interact in important ways. So, for example, birds are in the tropics responding to changes in daylight and changes in temperature in terms of when they come north, but the insects that are up here are responding to changes in temperature, and they might emerge before the birds come that need the insects to feed their offspring. And so you wind up having these changes in timing that are not aligning, and you have these mismatches that can be very harmful. We're also seeing changes in the distributions of species, so where we find species on the landscape, their ranges. Species have been moving, on average, globally, 11 meters per decade upward in elevation and 17 kilometers per decade poleward in latitude. So species are moving to keep, basically, they're moving to stay still in climate space. They want to stay in an area that's climatically suitable for them. As it warms, they're tracking that area of climatic suitability across the landscape to stay comfortable. Because species are shifting their ranges in ways, again, that are not coincident, they're not all shifting at the same pace. They're not all shifting in the same direction because they have different abilities to move. They're responding at different rates. We expect to have the emergence of novel ecological communities. So basically, if you think about the communities that we have today, for example, a Doug fir forest, you walk into a Doug fir forest or into shrub steppe or into another habitat that you're familiar with, you know what you expect to find there. I expect to see Doug fir. I expect to see certain things like huckleberry in the understory. Those communities, even though they seem very static, are in fact pretty recent developments after the last ice ages, and in the future, we expect many of those associations between species to break down and to have new communities that we haven't seen before in response to new climates that we haven't necessarily seen before. So we have this very, there will be a lot of unexpected things that may happen to the communities that we think of as being quite stable today. And a lot of these changes in communities are not going to be happening steadily, not going to be happening slowly and steadily over the years. Many of them might happen quite suddenly, and they may be mediated by changes in disturbance. So when you have a large catastrophic wildfire, what grows back? What moves in afterwards? So we expect to see sometimes quite sudden changes in our communities that are mediated by disturbance. What kinds of changes and disturbance do we expect to see and have we seen? These include increased risk of wildfire. So, for example, the area burned in the Columbia River Basin is expected to double by the 2020s, triple by the 2040s, and potentially go up fivefold by the 2080s relative to historical fire. We've already seen changes in our fire regimes. Increased risk of insect outbreaks. In the near term, we expect, for example, mountain pine beetle outbreaks to increase, particularly at higher elevations as it gets warmer and the mountain pine beetle itself is responding to climate change and moving into areas that is more that is within its climate envelope as it moves up in elevation. As it gets drier and hotter and trees get stressed, they may be more susceptible to insect and pathogens. In the longer term, in the shorter term, this will exacerbate fire risk as well, though in the longer term, insect outbreaks past a certain point may in fact reduce fire risk. So as far as how all of these changes play out on the landscape and looking at our communities of species on the landscape, we expect a lot of change. So this is one model of turnover in species, or vertebrate species, by the end of the century under a business-as-usual emission scenario. This is for one climate model. These would change if you looked at different climate models subtly. What I want you to see, for example, are the areas in purple. These are areas we expect a high amount of species turnover. In other words, many species will be moving out of these areas that live there today, and many species will be moving into those areas that live there today. They will be very different species there in the future. A lot of these areas are, for example, at mid-elevations. At mid-elevations, you don't have to move quite that far upward in elevation to get to a cooler habitat. You don't have to move that quite far upward to get to that habitat to begin with. So we see a lot of turnover there. In flatter areas, lower elevation areas, like the Puget Lowlands or the coast or the Columbia Plateau, we don't expect to see nearly as much change. In the areas in orange here, like the Okanagan Valley, we expect to see a net loss of species where we have species moving out of those hot valleys up into higher elevation areas to stay cool. But there is nowhere nearby that has a hotter climate that we expect to be there in the future to act as a source for species to move in the future. So we may see a net loss of species in some areas like that. Again, this is one model that results very subtly, but the point of showing this model is just to say that our conservation approach, the way that we think about conservation on the landscape, has traditionally relied on a static view of the landscape, more or less, where we expect this is where the species we really care about live right now, that's where we invest a lot of our resources, or this is an area of really high species richness or really high diversity, we want to put a protected area there. They're not going to stay there necessarily. Things will be moving around. Those areas of high biodiversity may change. Where species we care about live may change, and so we have this dynamic future landscape that's going to challenge the way that we do conservation. And so the meat of the talk that I gave last year that I was asked to more or less deliver today is, given this dynamic landscape, where do we direct our conservation resources in the future? Where do we direct our management efforts, whether it's acquisition or any other management activity that we do in the future? There are several different ways we could go about choosing spatial priority areas for climate change, those areas that we invest in. Maybe we want to pick places that help species avoid climate change. So there are certain areas on the landscape that may see less change, not as quite the same amount of warming, maybe not as much a loss of snowpack. Those areas we call climatic refugia. It's a refuge you could hang out in and potentially avoid areas of change. So maybe we want to protect climate refugia. Or maybe we want to help species adapt to change and conduct those range shifts they have to do. So maybe we want to protect elevational corridors that allow species to move uphill, or we want to protect latitudinal gradient corridors that allow species to move poleward to get to where they need to go. Maybe we really want to maintain our existing biological communities. Maybe it's a meadow at Paradise on Rainier or Bust, and we're going to protect that spot, and we're going to cut down trees as they move in, and we're going to keep it the way it is. Or maybe we want to look at the places that we expect to have really high biodiversity in the future, and that's where we should put our money, because that's where we think species are going to go. Even if we chose one of these, how would we identify these areas? I would argue that there is no single correct model that scientists can give you, or single approach that would identify for you your priority areas. There are many available models and tools that scientists are developing to predict where we expect to see changes in biological communities in the future, where we expect to see high levels of diversity or low levels of diversity in the future, tools to help species adapt in various ways. And they all can be useful in different ways, and I'll walk through them really quickly. But oh, that's interesting. But my slide got a little funny. Essentially, you can divide these tools and approaches that scientists are providing into two primary categories. There are coarse filter approaches and there are fine filter approaches. And these are classic conservation concepts, where coarse filter is thinking more about the landscape and at a very coarse scale. What could you do on the landscape? Where could you protect on the landscape that might protect many species at once, no particular species? Whereas a fine filter approach is really focused on individual species and what could you do to protect them. I'm going to walk through a series of maps that are model outputs that try to identify these areas and explain what they mean. I'm going to skip my initial introduction of them in the interest of time. So here is one approach. This is a coarse filter approach that was developed by the Nature Conservancy in Oregon for the Northwest, and this was their Northwest Resilient Sites project. And the approach that they took has been referred to as a land facet or an enduring features approach. And the idea here is that there's so much uncertainty about how climate change is going to proceed and how species will respond, that maybe our best bet is focusing on the enduring features of our physical landscape and how they support biodiversity. So, for example, making sure that we have a portfolio of land forms and facets, different soil types, for example. Let's make sure that we have some representation of, for example, low valleys with deep soils or basalt outcroppings or high elevation rocky areas, all of the different abiotic features that support different kinds of biodiversity. And if we make sure we have this network in place, and the species can sort themselves out, they can move at their own pace, but at least the stage that they need to be successful will still be either because we thought about this. And so these areas here on the map, the colored polygons across the Northwest, are the areas that they identified as being important to maintain this network of different kinds of enduring features across the Northwest, where the areas that are in a blue-green are expected to be really valuable on down until you get to brown, which are less valuable, and then gray, which they have not prioritized. And so that's one approach that has been very appealing to many people because of that avoidance of uncertainty that's associated with some of these models of where we think species are going to go. Here's a product that came out of work of the Washington Habitat Connectivity Working Group, of which the WDFW is a co-lead with Washington Department of Transportation. This product that they came up with looked at connecting areas on the landscape that are in really good condition. So the blocks of land here that are different colors, those are areas that have relatively few roads, few dwellings, they're in good condition. And they've connected areas that are in good condition that differ in temperature. So they've connected warm blocks of land in good condition to cooler blocks of land in good condition. So the warmer colors in the Columbia Plateau, those are pretty hot core areas of habitat. And then as you move up into the Cascades and the coastal range, those are much cooler. And they've connected them with these corridors, which are the glowing white areas between them, that avoid areas of heavy land use and follow gentle climatic gradients. So it's basically linking a stepping stone network across the landscape so that if you're a species, no particular species, it's a coarse filter approach. If you're a species that lives in a warm area, this might allow you a way to sort of escape hatch up into cooler and cooler areas, whether that's in elevation or in latitude, as it warms. So this is to promote rain shifts. Here is another coarse filter approach focusing on riparian areas. So these are looking at riparian areas, which currently are really important movement corridors for many species. They're much cooler generally than upland areas. A lot of upland species also depend on riparian areas for habitat and use them as movement corridors. And this analysis is another coarse filter approach that looked at riparian areas and prioritized them based on their condition, the amount to which they span climatic gradients that would allow species to move upward into cooler areas as it warms. And it provided this for the Northwest. Here's another, and you're getting my picture now, which is that there are a lot of tools out there. So here's another approach. This one is looking at climate velocity. So climate velocity is how far would you have to move per year to keep in your current climate. So if you're comfortable at 70 degrees Fahrenheit and a certain amount of precipitation, how fast would you have to move to stay in that climate envelope as it warms? And so what you can see here, for example, is that if you're in the Cascades, you don't have to move that fast. You don't have to move very far. You can just move a little bit up in elevation as it warms, and you're going to stay in the same temperature. If you're somewhere like the Columbia Plateau that's flat and hot, you're going to have to move really far, really fast to stay in your current temperature as it warms, because there's no easy way to get up. Climate temperature cools much more slowly across latitude than across elevation. Okay, now moving into fine filter. Those are all coarse filter. Those weren't looking at specific species. You can look at something like what I showed you earlier, which is that map of projected vertebrate species turnover. Maybe you want areas with low turnover. Maybe those are the areas that would be useful, that you think would be valuable. So maybe this is now, as you can see, giving you the opposite answer as before. If you want the Columbia Plateau, that's an area of very high climate velocity. Species have to really hoof it to get out of the plateau. But here we're showing, because of that, very low turnover of species in that area. Not many are moving out, not many are moving in. So you could get to very different answers depending on the tool that you use. Maybe you really care about wolverine and you want to say, I'm going to protect areas that we expect wolverine to persist into the future. And this is, I guess, a touchy subject right now with the ruling and the turnover with ESA. But so for wolverine, this model is showing, for example, the orange areas are areas of projected contraction, areas we expect wolverine to no longer be present in the future. These are potential areas, I should say, areas because they're not on Vancouver Island anymore, for example. This is where we expect them to be climatically suitable right now. So orange areas, we expect them to move out of in the future. Green areas are areas of stability, and blue areas are areas of projected expansion. So maybe you want to focus on the green areas, for example, if what you care about is a particular species. I'll skip this one and end with the cold water refugia. So for fish, one area that's gotten a lot of interest is looking for cold water refugia, areas where cold temperatures are expected to persist into the future. And this is work that Dan Isaac from the Forest Service and others done that they've called the climate shield. So if you're interested in bull trout, you pick the blue areas. That might be your decision here. And so that was intentionally a very whirlwind look at all of these different approaches that are coming out of scientific research to try to help managers decide where they should be investing their conservation resources in the future. And my argument is simply that there is, even though I know there's a lot of desire for science to give the answer on what to do about climate change and where to do it, that answer cannot come from the science. The science cannot provide a silver bullet. But working together, you can use these tools as a with a process for aiming some silver buckshot at the problem. And so ultimately, people, managers, multiple stakeholders need to collectively choose our priorities using these tools based on our conservation goals. Do we want to protect things as they are now, the things that we've identified as priorities now, into the future, even though some of those things might be very difficult to protect into the future, or some may be less so. So we might need to revisit our conservation goals or decide what they are together. Our conservation targets, do we focus on the same species we've been focusing on? Do we consider the fact that we may see some very big changes in the species that may be present in Washington, in our waters, and on our lands in the future? Do we want to accommodate that change, or do we want to resist that change? What do we want to do about it? There's no right answer. The scale of conservation, if you're operating at the scale of the Northwest or the state or your watershed or your stream, you might have a pretty different answer. And then dealing with uncertainty, some of these models have much more uncertainty incorporated into them than others. Some of them look gorgeous. Maps look great. They look very certain. We have a cognitive bias when we look at them, but there's a high degree of uncertainty in a lot of these models. And so figuring out your comfort with that, how that jibes with your mandates in incorporating uncertainty and the best available science into your work, these are all things to consider. And so ultimately, my suggestion would be to begin by inventory and evaluating the suite of available approaches and data sets that science can provide to help figure out where to invest conservation resources in the future. That ultimately, because of the scale that we're talking about, no single agency in its land holdings are going to be able to accommodate these shifts in species ranges and species needs for refugia under climate change. Ultimately, it's going to have to take a range of stakeholders, of landowners and agencies that are going to have to reach some consensus around their conservation goals, targets, scales, and approaches to identify their priorities together and develop ultimately a collective vision of what a conservation network should look like for Washington, Cascadia, and the Northwest in general. These are large continental scale problems, and in the Northwest, it's going to have to require a lot of collaboration to decide how we want to invest our resources. And once we decide where we want to invest those resources, then we also have to work to figure out how we're going to manage those resources under climate change in the sense that there will be more fire, there will be more drought, there will be a lot of impacts coming down the pipe that we have to account for in our management as well. So again, thank you for inviting me. I recognize that is a little bit of a different talk than more of a, that was a lot of my own sort of opinion on what is going to be necessary, but I appreciate the chance to offer that to you today.
Thank you, Mead. And Lynn, thank you. Is there...
I have another little piece to share,
okay.
Or we could take questions now, whichever you like.
Whatever your pleasure is.
I will, if it's okay with you, I'll just
go ahead.
Go through my slides,
sure.
And there are just a few of them. Was it? That's okay. So as I mentioned at the beginning, I wanted to put some of these very provocative big questions that Mead has raised into the context of what we're doing here at the agency. And I want to start with this slide, which has helped me a lot as we have grappled with how to inform our own response to climate change. And so most of you know, about 8 years ago, the agency launched into its response. I've been around for about 6 years, and I think we've made some good progress. So... there's two different perspectives I want to share, and one is sort of consistent with the approaches that Mead was talking about, sort of a top-down landscape-level look at it. And in here, you start with the climate impact. How will climate impact a species or habitat that we are concerned about and how should we respond. So say we're interested in rising stream temperatures. How is that going to impact the aquatic resources we help manage? Where is it going to be worse? Where is it going to be mitigated? And then, for example, how might these warming stream temperatures affect the distribution of bull trout? Are some places, as Mead talked about, going to be more resilient than others? What should we do with that information? What kinds of decisions might that inform? So that's a really valid and important way to think about it, looking at it sort of from the top down. The other way, and where we maybe have spent a little bit more concerted effort here at the agency, is what I like to call bottom-up or project focus. And here we start with a decision or action that we're taking. And climate change or no climate change, we are active and busy every day at the agency making all kinds of decisions. We issue permits, do recovery plans, operate hatcheries, set fishery and hunting seasons, all the business that we're engaged in. So the other way to sort of think about it is think about which of those actions or decisions are going to be sensitive to climate change and how, and where are we potentially at risk because of that sensitivity or that nexus in a near-term or long-term. For example, we're responsible for permitting water crossing structures for the fish passage. So we just completed a two-year project to look exactly at this question. How is that activity going to be sensitive to climate change? We teamed up with some researchers from the Climate Impacts Group to gather together data on downscale data on how stream flows would change across the watersheds across Washington State, and translated that into metrics that our engineers use, parameters that they use to size culverts. And we realized that, yes, indeed, it is a very sensitive activity. And, yes, indeed, now we have some spatial tools that show us that some areas of the state, using our current – we have a fairly high confidence that using our current design guidance may be undersized if we're sizing culverts with our current methodology. So this is a way to sort of look at – dive in deeper to what it is we do and how that might be at risk. And the other, I have just two more slides here. And the other way I wanted to try and frame this, if you will, is to go back to this slide that I've used many times. I always start with this slide when I'm talking to a group about the agency's response to climate change. We start with our strategic goals there on the bottom. And I've been working with an internal team to refresh these goals. And we've recently added a new one, which is this one down here at the bottom, to explicitly consider the risks of climate change in our investments and our resource planning. And that internal group has proposed a new policy for the agency that I want to mention here in a little bit. But the other way to sort of frame what we do and how we invest in making sure that we have the capacity to respond is to think about it in four different topic areas. So I think about it in terms of the science. So Mead did a beautiful job of saying, these are all the science products you could invest in. What's the research question you have? What's the management question you have? How do you want to use that science? Should we invest further in developing that riparian corridors report? Are we going to use that in our own acquisitions, et cetera? So what kind of science do we invest in? Making sure we have the capacity, and I certainly want to do more work, making sure we have better access to some of the tools and resources that our staff have access in the training for how to use sea level rise viewers, et cetera. Collaboration is always such a key part of what we do, of course, even more so with climate change. The example here, North Pacific Landscape Conservation Cooperatives is starting a new project looking at landscape I'm forgetting what they're calling it now, landscape conservation blueprint for the lower Columbia estuary and the coasts of Oregon and Washington. And they're looking at how does sea level rise going to affect our conservation priorities collectively in that area. And then, of course, the last one, most important, is what are we actually doing because we know all this information, right? What are we doing differently here at the agency, if anything? What makes sense to do differently in our core work? And this is where I feel like we have made some good progress over the years. We've been working on in our wildlife area planning to make sure we're integrating climate considerations as we prepare those 10-year plans. I just mentioned the culvert project where we're looking to try and understand if we should change our guidelines or not for how we design fish passage culverts. And so I think and then the Chehalis Basin Restoration Project has been looking at climate science from the very get-go of that project. So in a way, we're sort of ready to graduate. And that's what this internal team has recommended, that we bring a more systematic approach to how and a maybe a greater rigor and consistency to how we think about how we address climate in our work. And so That group is proposing a draft agency policy for climate change, and I want to emphasize that this is just now getting out to managers. We're scheduled to introduce it to EMT in July, so still very draft. But the purpose is really to establish direction for the agency to manage its own risks to our investments. We are proposing to adopt principles, which they've been nationally circulating, and they define a climate-ready organization. So there are things like we embrace future conditions. We consider future conditions when we're making decisions, not just current. Things like we adopt strategies that are robust to uncertainty, those kinds of things. And then the policy itself is that we're proposing draft, mind you, that it's our policy to manage our assets and our operations so as to better understand, mitigate, and adapt, and that we will assess the risks that climate poses to some key agency activities. And then in this proposed strategy, we lay out, we've done some pre-thinking about where these activities might be, where we might be at risk if we don't have a more systematic way of thinking about the risk of climate change. And I want to emphasize here that we don't want to create another layer of work. We don't want to do a check the box kind of thing. The idea is that much of what we do, we won't be thinking of it day to day. For example, in game management, most of what our folks are doing out there on the ground, setting seasons, that's not the right time to talk about climate change. But when you're doing your game management plan, your 6-year plan, that's the time to think about, hey, we're starting to see some of these shifts. Does anything need to change? Same thing with our wildlife area plans. Or a few months ago, I was in front of you talking about our climate change and our state wildlife action plan. So the idea is to really address it when it makes sense, when it's climate sensitive. So that's the idea. And there's another implementation part of this policy where we would develop some guidance. We would work with an agency team. We would make sure we took the time to do this thoughtfully and make sure that folks have the tools they need. When you're sort of looking at a new hatchery, for example, how do you know that you've fully identified the changes in water flow, watershed processes, whatever might be affecting your facility? And I don't know if I mentioned that it's draft. Just didn't want to get in any trouble there. So, and that's all I wanted to share, just sort of like a maybe a more dialed-down look. Me paints the big landscape picture. These are big questions we need to think about, certainly as an agency, and we engage at that level, and we also need to think about it sort of from this project up.
Thank you, Lynn. I'm glad we saved the simple issues till the afternoon.
Yeah.
Yes.
Thank you very much, Dr. Crosby and Lynn. It was, when I heard this talk, you know, it's never the easiest thing to think about, and climate change is not an easy thing to see or to even try to get your head around. And I think because we can't see it very, you know, in a clear way in many cases, it's easy to put out of our mind and get back to the hunting season and the fishing seasons. And so, you know, I think as a commission, we'd be remiss to not think about this. Especially whether we have shrinking dollars, and if we're applying dollars in a way that don't make sense from a trying to understand how climate change is going to affect our world and the world of the wildlife and fish and wildlife that we're trying to protect, you know, it would be a waste of dollars. So I really appreciate the different models, knowing there's no one answer. I live on the Okanagan River, and I overlook a pasture that has low spots, and every year the water comes up in the low spots. And I've lived there 10 years now. And the first 5 years, it was always in June. The first water would show up. I'd go, uh-oh, because I have a building in downtown Omak that when it gets a foot deep in my pasture, it's a foot deep in my basement. So I have to go throw a sump pump in. And so I watch that, and the geese come, the ducks come, and they have little hatchlings, and it's really fun. And I think, oh, and the hydrograph on the Tenasket River has to reach 16 before I see the first water in my little low spots. Well, in the first 5 years, like I said, that always occurred in June, just like clockwork. And I would talk to people, and I'd say, oh, yeah, high water is always June. It's always June. It's always been June. Then about year 6, 7, and 8, there was no high water. You know, there was 2 or 3 years where it just didn't come up at all. And then what I'm starting to notice is, like, last year it came up in May, and this year we're done. It happened in April, and the runoff's already occurred. And had to go down to the building downtown in April, and I'm thinking, wow, am I seeing climate change? Is it really that visible that I'm actually seeing these things happen? And I think we're all going to start seeing some of those things happen, and it's going to be something different for everyone where they go, oh, that meadow greened up quicker. You know, I'm seeing elk in there at a different time than I used to see elk in there. So anyway, I really appreciate the talk, and I hope the commission appreciated it, because it's not an easy thing to think about, but it's real, and we need to think about it.
It's an easy thing to deny.
Yes. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any other questions down there?